Hi, and it's a beautiful Tuesday afternoon here on Near FM. Welcome to another show of Dramatic Dublin. This week, I'll be interviewing Phil Kingston, manager of the Outreach and Education Department in the Abbey Theatre. And I will be letting you know what's going on in theatres around Dublin. And of course, playing a stellar selection of music. I just want to welcome Phil Kingston to the show. Phil is the manager of the Outreach and Education Department in the Abbey Theatre. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Thank you very much, Alison. Nice to be here.
I suppose just crack on with the questions.
Okay.
Can you tell me a bit about your background in theatre?
Sure, yes. I originally trained as an actor, and I'd been an actor from a young age. I can remember my mother's fond attendance at some of my early showings in primary school, and I can remember enjoying performing from a very early age. But if I'm honest, I kind of grew up wanting to be a writer. I was a precocious reader, and I've always admired writing. But when I got to university, I realised I did a lot of acting there and realised how much I love the all-involving nature of it, the fact that it was all of you. You were up on stage using your body to communicate, and I decided to go on to drama school. And that's kind of, you know, where I took seriously the idea that you could have a career in theatre. And then after that, I worked a little bit in, I worked on stage, I worked in the radio, and I wrote plays. I did continue to write as well as writing a bit of television. So those are my kind of beginnings in theatre.
Yeah. And where did you study drama in drama school?
I studied at the Central School of Speech and Drama in London. There was, at the time, there was about 5 major drama schools at the time, and I think I applied for all of them, but only managed to audition for Central at the time. So I was very happy that they gave me a place. So, yeah, that's where I went.
And I'm sure they're happy too.
Well, I hope so. I should ask them, yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about the Abbey Outreach's participation in the East Wall for All project?
Yes, the East Wall for All project, I think that's an umbrella term for a number of things that they did in the area, of which there was an Abbey project, which we called Home from Home. And the project was, everything we do in the community and education department is connected to the programme on the Abbey stage. And at the time, The House by Tom Murphy was just about to be produced at the Abbey. This is a few years ago. And The House is based around the emigration, the sort of the phenomenon of emigration in the 50s and 60s, and the time in the summer when for 2 weeks a lot of the emigrants would come home again and spend like 2 weeks spending a lot of the money that they'd earned and trying to reconnect to their families and to where they come from before returning back to the building sites and the other places where they worked abroad in England and America. And it struck me that some of those stories that Tom was featuring in this play, we'd actually find some of the people who'd actually done that in East Wall amongst the, you know, 70, 80, 90-year-olds living there. So we went to talk to them and to ask them if they had gone to the UK or to America, if they had worked for Wimpy and these other companies. And from the stories that they told, not just of going abroad, but also of being left behind, We sort of fashioned a series of scenes, in the end, 12 scenes. 7 of them were written by a playwright called Darren Donoghue, who was a sort of an Abbey playwright. He was an alumni of the new playwrights programme at the Abbey. So it means that he's a promising playwright who the Abbey have invested sort of time and resources into encouraging. And he wrote 7 of those scenes, and then he started a writers' group amongst the local community, and they contributed another 5 scenes. And they were performed, first of all, on the Abbey stage one afternoon as a work in progress by a local amateur drama group of local sort of East Wall, from the East Wall community. Very well. They're a very talented group. And then they performed them at the Sean O'Casey Theatre, which is the East Wall Theatre, for a couple of nights. And it was an extraordinary experience, because it was obvious that some of these stories that they'd written about were stories that were sort of shared stories in the community. And you could feel the audience recognising the stories when they were on stage. So, yeah, that was our Home from Home project in East Wall.
And does the Abbey Outreach have connections with many local theatres, such as the Sean O'Casey, where they can liaise with local people?
Well, not a lot with local theatres, because there's not a lot around in that sense. I suppose there's the Viking and probably the New Theatre. What we tend to have is connections with local groups and with sort of common interest groups. The SAIL project, Kilbarrack Community Development Project, for example. So we'd have connections and relationships with particular groups, and they'd often show their work in the Abbey. If we possibly can, we like to show the culmination of a project at the Abbey at some point. It's usually in the afternoon for friends and family. But obviously, because of the Abbey status and because it's so important as a sort of a national icon, we try and make it a part of any project that there's some form of activity actually in the building itself. Yep.
And you bring productions to various local locations, like Beware the Risen People was performed in the Kilbarrack Community Centre, I believe, a few years ago. I was at a production there.
Yes, so that's an example of, that's quite a new innovation. It was called Abbey Unplugged. And that was, we took the Risen People to the Kilbarrack Community Development Project, the big hall they've got there, to Wheatfield Prison and to Larkin Community College. And those three venues were chosen because we had partnerships with those groups already. Now, that was the first time in a long time that we'd done anything like that. And, I mean, the Abbey does tour, and in fact, it'll be touring quite a lot next year. But to actually go to a non-theatre venue to directly reach the community, that is new and is very much a testament to the kind of the resurgence of interest in community work that's been happening over the last 3 or 4 years, I'd say.
Yeah. And do you feel it's been a success, and will it continue to happen?
Oh, yes, it was a success. It really was a success. And it will continue to happen. In fact, there is a plan, tentative plan at the moment. Everything is always a to be confirmed here, but there is a plan to do the same sort of thing next year with three more venues. I can't tell you the name of the play, but it's going to be 2016, so there's kind of a limited number of plays that we might be putting on to celebrate 2016. So I'll just leave it for the listeners to guess what it might be. But we are planning to take that again to a school, also to a large hospital-based community theatre space, and to one other venue, which is going to be decided in conjunction with the director. So yes, we're going to continue to do the Abbey Unplugged, but we also try and do a lot of work to bring theatre to the community, also through the school system as well, because we have a project called Priming the Canon, where we take a classic of the Irish canon like The Plough and the Stars or Dancing at Lunasa, and we take a child character from that story and commission a monologue from that child's point of view, and we take that show directly into schools. That's the idea. Or if we find a local venue around the country that wants to host one or two schools, then we can do it there as well. We've done that. And we've done that with two shows now, Me Molza, which is based on The Plough and the Stars, and Me Michael, which is based on Dancing at Lunasa. So that's another way that we have of taking theatre out of the building and into the community when we can.
And do you think that encourages people to actually attend the theatre itself?
Yes. I don't have the research at my fingertips, but it has been shown that if you take an art form to children, the younger the better. If they've been exposed to it, then they're much, much more likely to pursue that art form later in life, which is one of the reasons why we're trying to go to primary school, so that very early on, the magic of theatre, the delight, the extraordinariness of seeing somebody kind of acting in front of you, we want to get that to them as early as we possibly can. Because there's, you know, theatre is competing with a lot of other forms of entertainment, and they're much more accessible and immediate. I mean, the whole protocol, the whole ritual of going to the theatre is something that kind of has to be learnt, you know. And if parents aren't taking their children to pantomimes or things like that when they're young, and the kids have got things to watch on their phones, you know, which are much easier to access than having to go through the whole rigmarole of going somewhere, we have to be more exciting than that. Yeah,
that's it. And the Dreacht has an interesting project whereby they give cheap tickets to people who live in the Dublin 15 area. And they found that the people who have access to the cheaper tickets will go to see everything. Very and good. They go to see a very wide range of theatrical projects in the Dreacht because they're getting access at a reasonable price, whereas they might not be able to afford it on a normal basis.
Absolutely. I have got a dispensation to give highly discounted tickets to certain community groups, sort of at the discretion of the department. And usually what I say is, if that group can find a way of feeding back their response in some way so that we can evaluate it and record it and spread that on to other people, then I'm happy to arrange that. So that is also possible at the Abbey.
Would the Clappers be one of those groups?
Well, yes, the Clappers, that's interesting. I mean, the Clappers met actually this afternoon. The Clappers is a sort of informal audience response group, which was originally made of volunteers, people who used to come in quite regularly to the Abbey to sort of stuff envelopes and do the very sort of small jobs that, that sometimes you need a large group of people to do for a short amount of time. And what they discovered is that they were often retired and they often had a wealth of theatre-going experience. They had these great conversations. And so we started this group called the Clappers, which they named themselves. And we used to introduce them, for example, to actors or directors from the plays that they'd seen, that they could have a conversation about them. But also we did something which, you know, you were involved in, where we had them speak to young people and sort of compare responses to a play. And that was fascinating because I met with some of them just before I came here because we're trying to revamp it a bit. It's and sort of bring some more people into it. And they said that those encounters between the younger and the older generations, both very engaged in a play, were enormously rewarding. In fact, the Clappers don't ask for discounts because often the Clappers have got some disposable income. And what's interesting about that, Alison, actually, I should say, is that we did for a while occasionally toy with completely free tickets. But the problem with free tickets is that people don't come. If something's completely free, they don't value it. So even a nominal charge is often important so that people put value on something. But yes, the Clappers is alive and well. Yeah.
Yes, it was a very good choice of production that we had the discussion about, Alice in Wonderland, because our view of Alice in Wonderland was very, very different from that of the Clappers, due to the generation differences. It was very camp and very flamboyant, with a drag queen playing the Mad Hatter, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And the White Rabbit was in a silver lycra body stocking on roller skates.
That's right, yeah.
So I think they were quite taken aback, being raised in a strictly Catholic country and having always had that kind of, and that would have had an influence on their decisions and their opinions. And then to see something that in your face was probably a bit much.
Well, hang on, let me question you on that, because my memory of that is that the Clappers were more open-minded about the Alice in Wonderland than some of the Collège de Dieulinck students, in the sense that the students came being used to the sort of things that that Alice in Wonderland had shown, but being quite critical of it, being like, well, we didn't think it really worked. Whereas the Clappers' attitude was, we're not used to some of these things, the campness of it, the gaudiness of it, but we're more sympathetic to what they're trying to achieve. That was my memory of it. Do you remember it differently?
I just remember them finding it a bit too much.
Okay.
And I do know that some of the students in Collège de Dieulinck were a bit kind of trying to be critical and trying to say, well, what are they going for with this? But I found it thoroughly enjoyable, and I'm not normally a fan of musicals, I must say, but this one was particularly enjoyable, and I enjoyed the campness, I enjoyed the colourfulness of the whole production.
I must say, I loved it and was delighted in it. But it's, I've got to be honest with you, it's very hard for me to dislike an Abbey production, mainly because you often are so close to the making of it that it's very difficult not to feel involved in it. So I frequently like whatever goes on their stages, actually. Yeah.
But I suppose if you work for Cadbury's, you're not going to tell people you don't like chocolate.
Yes, that's true. That is true. Would I say whether I disliked something? Probably not. It would feel disloyal. But I can usually come up with an honest reason why I like most things. But yeah, you're right. It's hard. I'm not the most objective of commentators. Yeah.
Of course, but I wouldn't expect you to be. And it's difficult to find loyalty, particularly in this business.
You're not hardened already, are you, Alison?
I'm a bit jaded. I'm not going to lie to you. Okay. Just a little bit. But I'm open to have my mind changed if someone was really nice to me.
Hope springs eternal.
Absolutely.
Really, there are good people in the entertainment industry. I've met them.
Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome. Um, You commissioned Paddy Cunningham to change the setting of the of his play Deadly, about a gang crime in about gang crime in Glasgow, to Dublin. Where did you come across the play originally, and what made you feel that Dublin would be a suitable location for the storyline of the play?
I came across the play originally at the Imaginate Children's Festival in Edinburgh, which in which there was a buzz about it at the time, because it is it's an extremely well written play, and it was originally conceived purely for a kind of a theatre going audience. Paddy Cunningham, his main career is as a composer. He's worked a lot with Druid, for example, in the past. And he found himself in Scotland for sort of family reasons, having worked a lot in London with the National Theatre of the South Bank. But he was in Scotland, and he was working, I think, over in Glasgow. But at a certain point, anyway, he was travelling through Edinburgh and was kind of shocked by the difference between the centre of the affluent city and the outskirts. And so he wrote this play, and he wrote it very much for the existing theatre-going audience that he knew, which is a predominantly middle-class audience, you know. But what happened was that word spread to youth protection groups, youth at risk groups, which is what they call youth diversion groups in the UK. And people from those sectors started to come and see the show. And he started being invited to places like Young Offenders Institutes and prisons and things like this. So a show that started life as being very much part of mainstream conventional theatre was actually pulled into the community realm by the value of its content. And through that process, it ended up at the Imaginate Children's Festival. And the reason it came over to Ireland was originally that there was a plan for the Abbey and Louise Donlan of the Lime Tree Theatre in Limerick, and Nina Cruha from Axis Ballymun. We were trying to get it over as a sort of to do a sort of mini tour, because Limerick particularly would have been appropriate for it, in the sense that. But that fell through because we couldn't get the funding to actually bring the whole of the sort of Scottish team over. And it was at that point that I said to Paddy, well, could you do it with Irish actors? And he said, yes, I'd love to, because actually I'm Irish, and, you know, and I was, you know, grew up in Camden Street. So we could do it that way. Unfortunately, it meant that it ended up just being at the Abbey, but with an understanding that if any of the other theatres wanted to take it up in the future, that was possible. But what was exciting was he really wanted to rewrite it, because it's in iambic pentameter, and therefore the music of the language is extremely important. So he had to make it fit the particular argot, the register of Dublin slang as opposed to Edinburgh slang. So, for example, the original name was Fleeto, which is Edinburgh slang for a gang, a Fleeto. And so he had to, you know, the fact that it was called Deadly is a reflection of the fact that he changed quite a lot of it. I mean, he came over about 3 months before we put it on, and we met with youth reach groups in Harmonstown and Talla, and we read out the play to them, and they'd say things like, no, you wouldn't use that word, and yeah, no, you call that that. And he incorporated all those things into the script. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a very interesting questions and answers after the show, which was very engaging. With the audience was very engaged with the questions, and they all got involved. It was very interesting and very enlightening. And Paddy Cunningham was mentioned that he always enjoyed Irish phrasing, their turn of phrase, and somebody mentioned that perhaps he should get a copy of Overheard in Dublin.
Yes, good point. Well, actually, at the moment we're trying, Paddy has just recently got in contact with us saying he's writing another play set in Ireland, and he wants to come over and workshop it here, and we're trying to arrange that. We need to find a group of actors who'd be available to work with him, but he's obviously falling in love with the sound of the language. I mean, he said that quite explicitly. I want to write my next play with this sort of sound in my head, because he's, as you say, he's a composer first, so he has a real ear for language. Yeah,
The iambic pentameter was very strong. It made the piece very, very strong. It was almost a Shakespearean feel to it because of the iambic pentameter.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
It really, really worked for the piece. And it's unusual these days to see something that's written in iambic pentameter.
And what's interesting about that is that it's something like, I don't know the exact figures, but a rough guess, about 65% of the audience were completely new to the Abbey. Because they came from youth diversion groups around Dublin. We had a special relationship with An Garda Síor Cóna that we'd provide sort of tickets for groups. We'd work with them beforehand and we'd bring them in. And so to say that you've got a lot of young people who are already kind of kicking against conventionality were prepared to come into a theatre, watch a play in iambic pentameter, and go away very, very excited by what they'd seen was quite an achievement on Paddy's part, I'd say. Yeah,
I did notice their presence in the theatre, and I did notice that when they were walking out, they're like, yeah, that was deadly. I really enjoyed that.
Exactly. I mean,
which is fantastic.
You know, what more do you want? That's my job. That's one of the peaks of my job, is that happening. Yeah.
It was very good. And is there any chance it'll be coming back at all?
Well, there's no plans at the moment. I won't do that thing that people do again, maybe. Well, there are no plans at the moment. But we did have some discussion. It might go to America. There was somebody in America, a friend of one of the actors, actually, who runs a... who's part of a college... which is interested in community work, and he did sort of, you know, get in contact with me and say, let's talk about this. No plans at the moment, but, you know, hope springs eternal.
And these days you work as the community and education manager at the Abbey Theatre. I imagine this is a very time consuming job. Do you ever find time to write scripts or perform on stage?
There isn't actually time to write scripts or to perform to do any sort of performance that will require rehearsal, not at the moment, because I also have three young children and we live outside of the city. So there really isn't time, though I do very occasionally do the odd day on a film or voiceover. And ironically enough, I did about a 2-hour voiceover for a film recently, and it's got more hits if you look up my name, which I frequently do on Google. It's got more hits than any other thing I've ever done, because it was a voiceover for the film Frank by Lenny Abrahamson. I have a very, very small part right at the beginning when I'm on a radio in a baker's shop. And it's funny how those things work out. I mean, I can remember slogging for weeks and weeks and weeks to do shows in fringe venues in the UK, and like Two Men and a Dog saw them. But more people have heard me be a bad radio DJ on that film than anything else I've ever done, I think. And I do, you know, the sort of occasional thing, small part in a film or something like that when I get the chance.
Yeah. Do you still follow the storyline of Fair City?
No, I don't. There wasn't time. That requires quite a lot of commitment following the storyline of Fair City. And I really, really enjoyed writing the scripts for that. The process is that you write, I think it's two or three shadow scripts, and then you start to write a script for it. And I only managed to write one before things changed and I moved on to a different job. But I really enjoyed it. It's a fascinating genre to write for as a writer. And I did spend a bit of time storylining, which is when you all sit in a room for like from 9 to 5 thinking up the stories for the next 6 months. And that was a fascinating process too. I really enjoyed that. I tried to follow Red Rock for a while, and I did write to them saying, look, looking for any writers. I used to write for The Bill, but I haven't heard anything back yet. I think every single writer in the country is probably trying to write for Red Rock at the moment, so I wasn't surprised. But no, I haven't. It's time consuming to follow soaps, and I'm afraid I haven't been able to keep up.
I'm not ashamed to admit that I am a fan of Fair City, and I do indeed follow it.
Good for you.
However, I have a prejudice against The Bill, because when I was small, I used to insist that I liked Carnation Street because I was afraid I'd be sent to bed earlier. But as soon as the music for The Bill kicked in, it was like, right, bed.
Yeah.
So now, Even now, if I hear the theme tune for The Bill, I'm like, oh no, it's time for bed.
That's an impossible behaviour and conditioning to change. That's it. That's it. I understand that. Maybe I can give you some episodes of The Bill and change the music.
And you have worked in many areas of theatre and entertainment industries over the years, including giving workshops to school students and their parents, writing scripts for The Bill, and of course, Irish favourite Fair City. What would be some of the highlights of your fantastic career?
Okay. All right. That is hard to choose. I'll just go for three. When I first came to Ireland, I did a one-man show. I did two one-man shows, actually. One called Dr. Dylan and Miss Georgia, about transgender lives, and which involved me being two people. A man who used to be a woman called Dylan, James Dylan, I think it was called James Dylan, and coupled with an imagined character called Georgina, who was a man in Manchester who wanted to be a woman. And by the end of the play, he's dressed up as a woman. And his job is, Georgina's job is to imitate, he's an Ian Curtis lookalike imitator, so I had to dance like Ian Curtis from Joy Division during the play. And I wrote it myself, I performed it myself, and I remember the immense feeling of satisfaction in having doing that every night when I first got there. I did that on the Dublin Fringe, I think it was 2007 or 2008. And so that was a moment of great satisfaction. A second moment, I think, if it's something to do with the work that I've done with the Abbey, and that's that is very hard to choose, actually. Gosh, that's extraordinarily hard to choose. So there's a number of things going through my mind, actually, right at the moment. Come and try and choose one. All right, so Wheatfield Prison, doing Deadly at Wheatfield Prison, and the quality of the prisoners' attention as they watched Deadly. And there was a moment when some of them walked out, not because they were bored, but because it was hard to stay with what was happening. And though this sounds odd, because I was confident that those men there'd be a way for them to sort of sort out their response, I saw the power of theatre in that moment. And that was a moment that made me feel proud that theatre was reaching people it wasn't ordinarily reaching. I think that'd be another thing to say. And this is a slightly odd one, but the Abbey did a series of things called a noble call at the end of the Risen People. Yeah. And one of which obviously was Panties, which went viral. But in order to do that, they had to test it at the dress rehearsal. Now, they didn't want to, as it were, waste a celebrity by asking somebody to do a speech at the dress rehearsal, which would be seen by nobody other than a few people around the building. But they needed somebody who could perform. And as I'd been an actor and I'd acted at the Abbey by then, before I got this job, I'd acted there as an actor, they said to me, well, will you do it just to try it out? And so I learned the poem Larkin by Patrick Kavanagh. And I got up on stage, and everybody's very unsure whether it would work. They're a bit concerned. And so I got up on stage and recited the poem, and the actors from The Risen People welcomed me on stage, and I stood and recited the poem. And I worked on it quite hard. I used to come in early every morning to practice, because it'd be a while since I'd done the acting. And there was a very strong feeling of satisfaction at the end of that. I did love acting on the Abbey stage, and I remember at the end of that, and it went down well, and people said it worked, and from that they realised that a noble call would work because they tested it out. That gave me a lot of satisfaction. Yeah,
that'd be amazing. I think any experience on the Abbey stage, of acting on the Abbey stage, would be an incredible experience. Will you be getting involved in the Dublin Fringe Festival and the Dublin Theatre Festival this year?
Well, we don't have any projects in it. Ah, no, tell a lie. Actually, we do. We do in the Dublin Theatre Festival. This is a first off, but hopefully it'll be something we'll do every year. We've got a group from Belong To, the group for LGBT teenagers, and they'll be seeing five shows in the Dublin Theatre Festival and working with artists from those shows, as well as an Abbey facilitator. And then at the end of the festival, they're going to perform on the Abbey stage a short piece of theatre that they devised in response to the shows they've seen about family, about the nature of family. So that's one of the things we're going to be doing for the Dublin Theatre Festival.
Will that be on the Abbey stage, or?
It will be. It'll be open to friends and family. We usually, but if as it evolves, it looks to me like it's going to be a piece of work of a high standard, I might open it generally to the public. But I have to make that call halfway through the project, because sometimes you don't want to expose people too early.
Yeah, you don't want to reach the Abbey stage and realise you're not ready for it.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah,
it's best to wait until you've matured and are ready for it, because that way you can perform, you can shine, and you can be proud of that moment.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah.
Well, I think so, anyway. Is there anything in the Dublin Theatre that you'll be looking forward to yourself, in particular?
Well, I know the Dublin Theatre Festival are working with Belvedere Youth Club. I'm interested in seeing how that goes. I always love the show and the bag stuff. I always love that. I tend to always go to the family events in Dublin Theatre Festival too, because Community and Education Department of the Abbey has also got responsibility for theatre for young audiences, so it's good to see work for young audiences. excuse me. I mean, Amy Conroy's play, Luck Just Kissed Me Hello, I think I've quoted that right. I've loved her work. I thought I Heart Amy Heart I was just a fantastic piece of work, so looking forward to that. Shane O'Reilly's doing a one-man show about matadors in the show in the bag for the Fringe. Shane's a fantastic performer. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing what he does with that. There's a play with Eric O'Brien and Jed Murray. Again, a show in the bag. I know both those performers sort of individually, and just the fact that I know them makes me want to go and see that. Those are a few of the highlights to step out. We're going to see The Train, of course, The Train by... oh, that wonderful chap who did Improbable Frequency. I can't remember his name. Arthur Reardon.
Yeah, from Rough Magic.
Fantastic lyricist. I mean, just there was a little excerpt of it at the launch of the Dublin Theatre Festival, and it seemed amazing. So I'm looking forward to that too. Yeah.
Yeah, he did a wonderful adaptation of Peer Gynt in the Belvedere Theatre, in the Roddy Theatre, Belvedere College, which was fabulous with an original score. And it was almost as if it was written in verse, and it was almost like the character was rapping.
Absolutely. Rory Nolan played Pierre. I think I remember that. I really enjoyed that. Yeah.
And I'd brought my mum to see that performance, and it went on for just over 3 hours. And I was going, oh no. But she came out saying that she really enjoyed it, and she was more than happy to come to see other shows with me after that, which is great.
Very good. Great. That's what you want.
Exactly. Converting people to our thespian beliefs.
Exactly. Outreach. That's what it's all about, Alison.
It is indeed. Well, listen, thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been great having you. I'm looking forward to keeping up with all your projects, and do keep in touch.
Let
us know if there's anything that you'd like me to mention on the show.
Absolutely. Oh, yes, please. Thank you. Yeah. We'll have you facilitating for us at some point, yeah?
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy. Please do. You have my email address.
I do.
Anytime.
Great.
Listen, thanks again. Take care now and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thanks very much.
See you now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So we've come to the part of the show where I tell you what's going on in theatres around Dublin. In Smock Alley, we have Waiting for Godot, a Samuel Beckett classic, which is back by popular demand for 1 week only before embarking on a tour of Brazil. A country road, a tree, evening. Vladimir and Estragon wait endlessly for the arrival of Godot, discussing religion, contemplating suicide, and crotch rot, in a comical wordplay of poetry, dreamscapes, and nonsense. A tragicomedy in two acts, Beckett's play pioneered an expressionistic minimalism that captured the existential post-World War II Europe and man's inexhaustible search for meaning. They give birth astride a grave. The light gleams for an instant, then it's night once more. It simply seeds with an energy that perhaps runs counter to the downbeat struggle of the two tramps, Vladimir and Estragon, with the futility of existence, but at the same time it sheds new light on a work that many of us are perhaps over-familiar with, throwing things previously unnoticed into relief. Every detail is thoroughly fleshed out. Every drop of bleak portent wrung from each word, phrase, and situation. That was a quote from John McKeown and from the Irish Independent on August 2014. This show is going to run from the 24th to the 29th of August at 7:30 p.m. in the main space at Smock Alley. And there's also a Saturday matinee at 2:30 p.m. Tickets will be €15 or €12 concession. And there's also a summer offer of dinner and a show for €30. On Thursday the 27th and Friday the 28th of August, you can enjoy a specially designed seasonal pre-show dinner with a glass of wine in their banquet hall and a ticket to the show for only €30. Sounds good value to me. In the Dolman Theatre, we have Elvis Is My Daddy. In the 1970s, Lana Lavelle was a huge star in Las Vegas, playing in the big casinos alongside Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra and Elvis. It all went wrong, and she returned home to Ireland pregnant in 1977. For almost 40 years, she has lived a reclusive life with her two daughters. Now, due to a change in circumstances, she is making a comeback. And although much has changed, Lana refuses to accept that stardom now entails appearing on reality shows, selling your soul on Twitter, and sharing the chat show sofa with someone who has written a cookbook. Lana is out to remind us of what real stardom looks like. She will appear alongside her two daughters, Bette Davis Lavelle, a shy, retiring wolf lair with a musical talent that her mother may have seriously underestimated, and her sister, Lulabelle Lavelle, a gorgeous slut with a surly attitude, a caustic line in put-downs, and a very poor work ethic. It has been said that the relationship between this mother and her children is so dysfunctional that they make the Borgias look like a Disney flick. However, Lana hopes that the tour will help them to bond. There have always been rumours that Lana had a dalliance with Elvis, and that one of her girls may be the daughter of the King of Rock and Roll himself. Tonight, in a rock and roll retro extravaganza, Lana reminds the world of the enormous talent that we have all been denied for nearly four decades, and finally sets the record straight. This show will be running from August the 24th to Saturday the 29th. It's produced by Playbag Productions. Tickets are €12. At the New Theatre, Language of the Mute by Jack Hart will run from August the 24th to September the 5th. Inspired by real-life events, Jack Hart's shattering new play shines a light on sinister exploitation and the search for justice. A reunion of former friends. Questions asked, silence broken, truths revealed. Revenge or justice? There are choices to be made. Bin Bale in a host. Silence is golden, sweet as the shut mouth. A charismatic teacher, a supporter of fundamentalist republicanism, and Irish language activist, whose overt and very public idealism masks a history of sexual and psychological exploitation, is confronted by his former pupils. The play examines how charisma and idealism can be used to exploit people sexually, politically, and socially. The core of the problem and the core of the solution is language and communication. The play shows how ultimately love can triumph over cynicism, how idealism can endure. This will be running in the New Theatre from the 24th of August to the 5th of September. Tickets are €15 or €12 concession. I'll be back after a little bit of music.